necessarily be any mobilization. We got out there early. The whistleblowers did their job. That was a tremendous victory for grassroots involvement to protect health care for low-income people. That's chutzpah to do that kind of thing. Mm.
Well, Ron Wyden, I want to thank you for being with us. Longtime Democratic senator from Oregon. His new book, It Takes Chutzpah, How to Fight Fearlessly for Progressive Change. When we come back, we'll get the latest from Washington after this airline carrying 64 people, many young skaters coming back from the Nationals in a training camp in Wichita, collides with an Army Black Hawk helicopter near Reagan National Airport. No one is believed to have survived. We'll speak with The Lever's David Sirota, and then we'll go to the Middle East. Stay with us. Working Overtime by Ecstasy. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Rescue workers in Washington, D.C. have launched a massive search operation in the Potomac River after an American Airlines flight and a U.S. Army Black Hawk helicopter collided mid-air late Wednesday, with both aircraft crashing into the water. Officials say there are likely no survivors. At least 30 bodies have been pulled from the river. American Airlines Flight 5342 had 60 passengers and four crew members on board and was en route to the D.C. area Reagan National Airport from Wichita, Kansas. The Black Hawk helicopter had three soldiers on board conducting a training flight. The National Transportation Safety Board will investigate with the Federal Aviation Administration.
The crash comes just days after the head of the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, Mike Whitaker, stepped down. FAA administrators usually serve five-year terms. Trump has not named a replacement. Whitaker announced his planned departure in December after SpaceX CEO, Trump donor, richest man in the world, Elon Musk, repeatedly attacked him on social media, tweeting he needs to resign. Musk was responding to $600,000 in FAA fines against SpaceX for safety violations along Florida's Space Coast. For more, we're joined by David Sirota, editor-in-chief of The Lever, which has a new report headlined Before D.C. Airport Collision, Lawmakers Brushed Off Warnings and Boosted Flights. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, David. You know, this story is so horrific. I know the skating community well. My sister-in-law was almost in the Olympics as a skater, her mother a coach. The horror that many on the flight were young ones who were training for ultimately to go into the Olympics, their families waiting at Reagan Airport. The American Airlines flight, taking them back from Wichita training camp after the Nationals, collides with an Army Black Hawk helicopter. They say it was a training flight. Can you talk about this piece that you wrote? Despite mid-flight near misses and dire pleas, airline bankrolled lawmakers recently expanded flight traffic at Washington's busy airport. David, I just watched the news briefing. There was the two Virginia senators who objected to this expansion, right? Tim Kaine, as well as Senator Warner. They didn't mention that this morning, but if you can talk all about it, give us some background.
Sure. So Washington National Airport is a relatively small airport and one of the busiest, if not the busiest airport in the country because of how close it is to the center of Washington, D.C., the city there. For years, there has been a debate about whether to expand the amount of flights that can go into Washington Reagan Airport. And over the course of a few decades, there has been a steady increase in the number of slots, that is to say, the amount of traffic at Washington National Airport, air traffic. And just a few months ago, as we reported, that debate over how much to expand Washington National hit a fever pitch in Congress. There's been a push by a set of airlines to expand those flights. There's some other airlines that don't want to expand those flights because they're already controlling those routes. So there's a sort of an economic battle going on, who gets to control what routes. But at the core of it, according to opponents of this, including the senators that you mentioned, there is a very deep safety concern at this airport because there had been a series of near misses, near collisions at the airport because it is so heavily trafficked. So a few months ago, put into the FAA authorization bill was some language that further expanded these slots and also the perimeter. That's the length of the flights that are allowed to come into Washington National. Basically, this is the opponents argue this is Congress people from cities farther away from Washington want more direct flights into Washington because it's more convenient for them. That's the opponent's argument. But again, at the core is the safety question. There have been real safety concerns, again, about these near misses at this particular airport. And so a few months ago, that language was slipped into the FAA reauthorization bill, which further expanded the traffic. And it should be said, when it actually came up for a vote in the House in 2023, the House voted it down. So there were some legislative machinations here in which the proponents of this had to slip it into a larger bill kind of stealthily to get this expansion passed. And Tim Kaine said he was very concerned about the prospect of collisions at this airport, begging lawmakers to not do this.
And could you talk, David Sirota, about the significance of the fact that the collision occurred with a Black Hawk helicopter?
Yeah, sure. Well, look, we don't know the exactly what happened and what is at issue here with an alleged training flight of helicopters. But I think it's worth saying this. If you've ever been near or flown into Washington National Airport, you can see it's some of the most heavily trafficked airspace in the world, including by the military. So I think what we're talking about here is whether an airport that is already so stressed, already so at capacity, arguably over capacity, whether it should have been the air traffic should have been expanded, knowing, again, it's also additional special circumstance of being around so much additional air traffic vis-a-vis the military.
And this whole idea of who is in charge of the military flights, I mean, this is unusual at this airport as opposed to all others. I was talking to someone who was saying that pilots actually most fear this airport. It's one of the most dangerous in the country, where you have all these Black Hawk helicopters and they take military officials and other officials. And then you've got all the civilian flights that they keep increasing. How much do they communicate with each other, David?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I have seen some reporting saying that the radar wasn't communicating on this training flight. I'm not sure that's been substantiated. So I'm not trying to put out misinformation
right.
or disinformation.
These are just the questions.
It's only to say that again. This particular space, this airspace, has been a known safety hazard for a very long time, and certain airlines who spend money on lobbying Congress and campaign contributions to key members of Congress have been pushing to expand the amount of flights into this particular airport. And again, I just want to say one other thing here. This is a city that is served by a much larger airport farther out of the city, Dulles Airport. And so the argument has been, listen, we should not expand the amount of flights going into Washington Reagan, even though it's more convenient for passengers when you get off the plane because it's closer to the city, because we have a larger airport a little bit further away. So the argument was, again, this is members of Congress who want, for their convenience, to fly to the closest airport to their office. And the argument was that they were listening to their airline donors. They were listening to their desire for their own convenience, not listening to the multiple safety warnings about this airport.
And let's remember, it's called now Reagan National Airport, used to be National Airport, known for President Reagan. And President Reagan is known for breaking up the PATCO union, the Air Traffic Controllers Union, back in the 1980s.
Absolutely. And there's a question, there's been questions, and I don't know if it's germane to what happened in this disaster, but there have been questions about air traffic control resources, understaffing, the current staff being essentially overworked. All of these questions have been swirling for years. And so our job at The Lever, what we do is we look back at the decisions that were made in the lead up to situations like this. And again, these warnings about expanding the flight traffic at this airport came just a few months ago. I mean, if you go read our story, you will see legislators warning, really dire pleas to not expand the amount of traffic at this airport.
David Sirota, you are editor-in-chief of The Lever. You are following what's happening in Washington extremely closely. To say the least, we're talking about everything, everywhere, all at once, with the President Trump's inauguration and the number of executive orders, the number of hearings for his nominees to be in his cabinet. But you also have a massive amount of pushback. If you can talk about what just took place, the significance, and just your take over the last 10 days, but the significance of cutting trillions of dollars, or so-called pausing them, putting them on hold, and then because of the outcry, again, this hurting people, veterans, this hurting families in need, heating, housing assistance, Meals on Wheels, Head Start. And suddenly, after the chaos of just a number of hours, the Trump administration almost says, sorry, only kidding.
Yeah, I mean, this is really unprecedented. And I say that having worked in the U.S. House Appropriations Committee back during and after 9/11. So I worked in the committees that dealt with the spending in this country, the budget in this country. And I have never seen, back then, and following it since then, had never seen something this brazen. Now, to be clear, the fight over the spending issue has been something that has happened in the distant past. Richard Nixon tried to so-called impound, that's holding back money appropriated by Congress. He tried to do that in the 70s. Congress passed a very explicit law saying, no, you actually cannot do this. Ronald Reagan explored doing this. John Roberts, by the way, as we reported, sent a memo when he was working in the Reagan administration saying essentially the president does not have the power to unilaterally withhold spending authorized by Congress and enshrined in law.
Justice of the United States.
That's right. And John Roberts would, if this kind of thing comes to the court, the Supreme Court, John Roberts would be weighing in on this. Look, this is unprecedented. Donald Trump effectively tried to unilaterally repeal the federal government by fiat, and he was rejected essentially by the American people. He was rejected temporarily by a court. And what I would say is it is a warning about what is coming, that while the reversal happened very quickly because of the outcry, because of the mass chaos that it sowed. That chaos here is the goal. Chaos in service of Trump grabbing more power for himself. If he was successful in this, and he will try it again, what he will essentially do is render the legislature powerless. He will essentially eliminate the authority of one of the branches of the U.S. government, the checks and balances, the most democratic branch. And the last thing I'll say here, Amy, which is really important, especially when it comes to spending, the reason the founders put the power of the purse in the power of the Congress, and specifically in the power of the House, is because the House is and the Congress are the most small d democratic parts of the government, the parts of the government that are supposed to be most responsive to the people. So the president trying to take away that power of the purse is a direct assault on the founding principles that spending decisions are made by the most democratic parts of our government.
David Sirota, we want to thank you so much for being with us, editor-in-chief of The Lever. He has a new report headlined, Before D.C. Airport Collision, Lawmakers Brushed Off Warnings and Boosted Flights. We'll link to it at democracynow.org. Coming up, we look at Gaza as Hamas releases 8 more hostages. Netanyahu planning to come to the White House next week to meet with President Trump, the first foreign leader to meet with President Trump at the White House. Stay with us. بعد ما نسي بعد الحجر قاعد صاف نفس السما بعد ما قسي بعد البحر شارد حامل كل السفن Mints of Memory by Faraj Suleiman. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Israel is scheduled to free 110 Palestinians, including 30 children, from its prisons after Hamas released 3 Israelis and 5 Thai nationals held hostage in Gaza since October 7, 2023. The exchange took place as Trump's Middle East envoy, Steve Witkoff, arrived in Israel and became the first senior American official to enter Gaza in nearly 15 years. Witkoff toured the Israeli-occupied Netzarim corridor separating northern and southern Gaza, embedded among Israeli soldiers. Witkoff is also meeting today with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who's scheduled to visit Trump at the White House next week. Netanyahu's trip comes just 2 months after the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for Netanyahu.
We're joined right now by Mohammed Shahada, writer and analyst from Gaza. He's chief of communications at Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor, joining us from Copenhagen. Mohammed, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you talk about what unfolded today in Gaza? And as of the time of this broadcast, what is expected to unfold when it comes to the prisoners released by Israel, Palestinian prisoners?
Sure. Thanks for having me, Amy. So today, Hamas released an Israeli soldier that was captured from Nahal Oz, a Gamburger, in addition to 2 other civilian Israeli hostages that were released in Khan Yunis and 5 Thai workers. There's a significance in the way that the release was conducted. A Gamburger was released basically in Jabalia, an area that Israel has wiped out over a process of over 100 days of systematically destroying every single building in the city. Nothing is left standing. And in Khan Yunis, the other hostages were released right in front of Yahya Sinwar's house, also an area that Israel invaded, wiped out systematically, bombed indiscriminately. So in both, there is the attempt to say that Israel had no clue throughout these 15 months how to get the hostages out militarily, and the only way to get them out is through a ceasefire, which has been the position mediators has been reiterating for over 15 months. The other thing is that Netanyahu is trying desperately to use any loopholes in the agreement to collapse the ceasefire. We saw that last Saturday when he was supposed to open up the Netzarim corridor and allow people to go to northern Gaza, and he withdrew from that last minute, postponed it indefinitely until mediators pressured him, and it happened on Monday in return for hostages that were released today outside of the framework. Today, he's delaying and procrastinating the release of Palestinian captives and prisoners, citing that Hamas's release of one of the hostages or two in Khan Yunis was overcrowded and hostile to the hostages themselves. So he's demanding a safe passage, quote unquote, which in other words, as Israeli media is warning us every single day, Netanyahu is trying everything he could to sabotage the deal from this early on. This is why you had Steve Witkoff go to Gaza to see it with his own eyes yesterday before he even met with Netanyahu, to signify how little trust he has in the Israeli prime minister to see the progress of the ceasefire on the ground himself. And also to emphasize to Netanyahu that the deal has to be seen through.
And so, Mohammed, could you talk a little bit more about that, the significance of Witkoff's visit? He was in Saudi Arabia before he came to Israel. He's the first senior, as you said, U.S. official in years to actually go in to Gaza. And today he met with Netanyahu, but also with his far-right cabinet minister, finance minister, Smotrich. So, you know, what do you make of this and your assessment of his work on the ceasefire, a ceasefire agreement that was reached that the Biden administration failed to reach?
Thanks, Nermeen. Very good question. So basically, with Witkoff, as you said, it's the first visit in over 15 years. The last time we had a similar visit was John Kerry when he was a U.S. senator in 2009, very brief, didn't even continue for over a day. So only border areas in Gaza and then left immediately. There was not even the pretense by any U.S. official ever since to want to see what's inside Gaza. So this is monumental in the sense that he broke a taboo that has been established for over a decade. The other thing is that with Witkoff's visit to Gaza, there's also, as you said, the meetings with far-right Israeli ministers. The parallel track that he's working on is the issue with transferring 1.5 million Gazans to neighboring countries. And Israeli media until last night have been saying that this is a dead serious topic that he's discussing seriously with Netanyahu and his ministers. At the same time, we got the pulse of different sources in Israel, like a cabinet minister who told the Times of Israel that this rhetoric about transferring Gazans outside might appease the Israeli far right and allow Netanyahu to carry on with the deal. It might give Israel the alternative victory image. They couldn't destroy Hamas militarily, but now they want to maintain Gaza as an uninhabitable territory to push people to leave. So that might give them this alternative victory image. But on the other side, you have Palestinians saying immediately, we're not going to leave no matter what. Israel tried that repeatedly. In 1951, that's when they first started trying to convince Egypt to take 12,000 Gazans and resettle them into Sinai. Gazans protested, dried it in an intifada in 55 and killed it. My own family were kicked out of Gaza in 67 to Egypt, and they were living there for about 27 years. They never forgot. They went back to Gaza as soon as there was an opportunity with the Oslo Accords. So it's not something that is gonna be workable for Trump to carry out. You have even people from his own camp, like senators, that are saying that this is unworkable, this is improbable.
Mohammed, also, you know, before we move to other issues, the significance of Trump inviting Netanyahu just as this is occurring next week to the White House.
Well, it has two significances. Number one is that the U.S. is signaling that international law is obsolete, that they tossed it into the garbage. The international rule-based order is no longer valid, because you have here someone with arrest warrants on his head by the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity being honored in Washington, D.C., in the White House, the highest executive branch of government. At the same time, the other significance is Trump has been showering Netanyahu, lavishing him and his far-right extremist ministers with an enormous unprecedented gift bag from the moment he walked into office. Some of these gifts are under the pretext of bribing Netanyahu to agree to the ceasefire, but other elements in there have to do more with an extremist messianic pro-Israeli agenda. So for example, you have an U.S. immediate lifting of all sanctions on Israeli settlers and extremist groups that the Biden administration imposed. You also have an immediate process to sanction the International Criminal Court and collapse it because it dared to go after Israel. You have that visit to Washington that Biden was reluctant to extend to Netanyahu despite Biden's full complicity in the Gaza genocide. And you have other gift bags that are being showered on Smotrich and Ben-Gvir and Netanyahu to buy their complicity and silence.
I wanted to ask you about UNRWA. International staff working for the UN's main agency serving Palestinians have been forced to leave Israel after its ban on the agency came into effect. This is the deputy U.S. ambassador to the United. I want to go to the UNRWA spokesperson, Jonathan Fowler, who said Israel's decision could trigger a collapse of humanitarian aid to Palestinians.
We're responsible for over half the deliveries inside the Gaza Strip, over half of the aid coming in. The UNRWA, I mean, has been described repeatedly, not by ourselves, but, you know, by others as the backbone of the international aid operation, because the rest of the aid operation is just the UN presence is just a few hundred people. A few hundred does not equal 5,000. Without UNRWA being able to operate, there's a very real risk of the humanitarian operation collapsing.
So this is extremely significant, Mohammed. UNRWA out. As all the Palestinians are flooding into northern Gaza, if you can talk about both of these issues. Of course, UNRWA is larger than Gaza. It's serving millions of Palestinians throughout the Middle East.
Precisely. Well, UNRWA is Gaza's lifeline. If you take it out, this is a death sentence to Gaza's population. Since the ceasefire was enacted, my inbox has been flooded with messages from colleagues, from family members, from friends and loved ones who are literally begging to help to find them any place to stay, to help to even find a tent in northern Gaza, to help to find food to put on the table. If you take UNRWA away, it gets only way worse than this. Whatever rudimentary basic level of survival that is sustained in Gaza now with the little aid that's coming in, a lot of it is going to be explicitly banned by Israel because the Israeli legislation, it bans any imports to Gaza with UNRWA's label on it, as well as dismantling UNRWA's network. Also, in Lebanon, for example, where Palestinians are living in refugee camps in abysmal conditions, UNRWA is a vital lifeline there. But it's not only a matter of service provider. UNRWA has played a transformative role for many Palestinians. My own father, whose family were kicked out in 48 by Israel to a refugee camp, the Shatil refugee camp in Gaza, he would have been a barefoot child with no life, with no income, with no purpose, if it wasn't for UNRWA providing the infrastructure for education that brought him up as the doctor that I was very proud of until his death because of Israel's blockade. I myself wouldn't be standing in front of you now and speaking English and even knowing about politics or the history of the conflict or the history of the Holocaust if it was not for my UNRWA educational system. I would have not had an educational opportunity. So if you take all of that away from Gazans, it falls into Israel's plan to prevent any capacity in Gaza to maintain organized human life so that people would have to leave, so that Gaza is being emptied out completely. And that's the main concern.
And Mohammed, finally, if you could talk about the continuing Israeli assault in the West Bank, in particular on Jenin.
So basically, part of the gift bag that Netanyahu gave to his extremist minister, Bezalel Smotrich, to agree to the ceasefire in Gaza was to extend the war goals under the radar quietly to include the West Bank. So now the West Bank, from Israel's perspective, is a war zone. So that's why you have, for example, Israeli checkpoints booming and skyrocketing all across the West Bank, despite the IDF chief of staff, who is a settler himself, Herzi Halevi. He is not a pro-Palestinian left wing, but that IDF chief of staff, he warned Netanyahu and Smotrich. He said, don't put these checkpoints. It will lead and push Palestinians to take to arms, to armed resistance, to resist Israel's occupation. But Netanyahu overruled him. In Jenin, you have a way worse dynamic than the rest of the West Bank, where Israel is trying to turn it into a clone of Gaza, ethnic cleansing, pushing people out and destroying homes systematically one after the other. All of it is to explode the West Bank, to use it as a pretext for a major war to push Palestinians out. That's the agenda of Israel's extremist ministers at the moment.
Mohammed Shahada, we thank you so much for being with us. Writer and analyst from Gaza, chief of communications at Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor. And that does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
February 13th is World Radio Day, where millions around the globe celebrate the medium which touches so many lives. All across this country, Canadians are celebrating too, including Farm Radio International and the National Campus and Community Radio Association, with a live broadcast through CKCU-FM from Ottawa. Learn more and participate in World Radio Day at worldradioday.ncra.ca on February 13th and catch the live stream.
Hey, do you want to make a real impact in the Black community? Join us where we connect you with Black-led organizations from all around the world. Get ready to get involved. Find the organization based on the location of interest. Follow us at Support Black Charity.